Are you trying to find the perfect distribution platform to get your music on Spotify and Apple? I personally use and love DistroKid. Go to mixingmusicpodcast.com/DistroKid to get a small discount and get access to a platform with unlimited uploads for a yearly fee. Happy uploading and enjoy the show. Hello and welcome back to the Mixing Music Podcast. I'm your host, DK, and today we're just going to do a little bonus solo episode. I'm by myself. I'm going to rant. This episode is mostly a lot for myself for archival purposes. But I think this episode's going to teach a lot to those that are struggling, that are learning about life themselves and figuring out which direction to go. And I'm really hoping that this helps someone else as much as it helped me. This one's not necessarily related to audio, hence why I'll probably release this as a bonus episode, not as one of the main ones. As many of y'all know, I've talked about a few times, I recently just finished my first 100-mile ultra marathon. I ran and walked for basically 35 hours straight and hit 100 miles. It was tough. I've been training for it for a while. I mean, there's only so much training that you can do for something like that, right? But I've been training for it. It's something that not only have I never done, but I don't personally know anybody. I didn't personally know anybody that has ever done that as well. So it was something that was so ridiculous that I didn't even know was achievable. And this is not about how awesome I am or how incredible the feat was. This is more about all the things that I learned before and afterwards. For example, one of the things that I learned is what it means to be a high achiever. It was really interesting. I thought this ultra marathon would be just a bunch of people that were, quite frankly, masochists, type A, David Goggins, pain cave, just all about just dealing with it, getting through it, and doing it because your dad beat you. I don't know. But I get there, and granted, not only do most people not even know a single person that does something like that? It's like, then you have all of these incredible people meeting at the same place, doing the same thing, with the united goal of just to finish. Not even necessarily to finish fast. Maybe there's two or three people that were trying to finish on a specific time. But it's such a big task that, for most people, it's just finishing. This year was particularly tough for this race. It's on a 2-mile loop, so you have to do it 50 times. And they have multiple events. They have the 50K, which is 31 miles. They have the 50-mile race. They have the 100-mile race. And then they have time-based ones, too, which is they had the 48-hour race, the 24-hour race, and the 72-hour race. The time-based ones, the finishers, the podium finishers, so first, second, third place is based off of how many miles you finish in that allotted time span. And then, of course, the distance ones are based off of how quickly you reach that distance. I thought that all these runners would be like masochistic, type A, everything that I described. And I get there, and I have, to this day, and I don't think I ever will, ever meet a group of happier, optimistic, friendly people in my entire life. And that really surprised me. I was expecting a group of people that were unfriendly, that were egoists, that were delusional, thought that they were the best. Probably a reflection of maybe why I got into running at first. And I only had one goal. And it seemed to be the goal of many others too. Well, two actually, but one was to finish. But that wasn't as important as my main goal, which was to keep a smile on the entire time, just to try to smile. My first marathon, ever regular marathon, was miserable. I started running like at that level competitively to see if I can do it, to try to prove something to myself. I just wasn't in the right headspace, and I find out that I'm not as fast or as strong as I thought I was. I was disappointed because I didn't hit the target time that I'd been training for. And I hit the finish, and it was just bittersweet. My family wasn't there when I thought that they would be. It was just expectations all in the wrong place, and it was good. I finished it, but it wasn't what I was hoping it would be. I finished it. I was proud. Don't get me wrong, but my expectations were all over the place. They were in the wrong place, and I didn't have fun. I don't think I had a smile on my face. It was just something I needed to do to finish because I said I would. It was a competitive thing. I was challenging myself. In retrospect, the last marathon I did before this ultra was a complete opposite. Not only did I run faster, and it was the same race, it was the LA Marathon. I did it for the second year in a row. Not only did I run faster, but I had a smile on the entire time. The song that really, it brought tears to my eyes while I was running. All of a sudden, I had my music on shuffle, and then I had both headphones in, so, the crowd and the runners, all the footsteps were kind of drowned out by Lewis Cole's song, Let It Happen. And it's just him repeating in a beautiful symphony, let it happen, let it happen, let it happen. You're not in control. Things are just going to happen. Just let it be. And, All the things kind of aligned at once. The years of therapy, the emotional overcoming that I've been able to do through running. Even having a younger disabled child, which I joke about most times, but in this case, I'm thinking of seriously. I feel like the last few years, I've really learned to let go of expectations, to not take life so seriously, to enjoy the moment. And it turns out that would be the secret sauce that I needed to find the motivation to finish the 100-mile ultramarathon. The last 30 miles from mile 70, I was already in pain. I was in pain from mile 20. Things, when you run, you'll know things hurt from time to time. And if you keep going, they eventually stop hurting, unless it's serious. And most of the time, it's not. You get to mile 70 and your feet are so on fire, they're sore, that you've never done that much in your life. You're not tired because, yes, you haven't slept, but you're moving. So your body is active. You're not at risk of falling asleep while running. You know, you're not passing out. But it starts to hurt real bad. It starts to hurt really bad. And I never thought that I wasn't going to make it. I knew I've ran 30 miles before. That was the most I've ever ran at any single point in a single day before that. So I went from 31 miles to freaking 100 miles as my best distance. During my training block, I did the Los Angeles Marathon, and then part of my training block was to run another slow marathon in my neighborhood the next day. So I ran 52 miles within 2 days, but that was really the most I've ever done. And to hit 100 miles in one day, well, across 2 days without sleeping, was a feat that there's no way to train for that. You're not just going to do that. And it was intimidating, it was scary, but the secret sauce was that I was able to keep on a smile. I really love running. So that's kind of the ending. Let me go back to the beginning a little bit here. I talk about this a lot. Running changed my life. Quite frankly, I don't know if I ever talked about it. And this episode, I'm not going to start divulging everything that I went through. But to put simply, moving to LA was not easy for me. I had a second son that I missed the birth of because I was in LA and my wife was in Utah. Because of insurance reasons, I had the baby in Utah. Very quickly, easy birth, came out. He was born prematurely, a month. Turns out he was Down syndrome, and his lungs and heart, he needed open heart surgery, as is pretty regular for Down syndrome kids. But his condition was worse and was bad enough that we couldn't take him home. He had to stay in the NICU for about 7 months, 6 months, and then he got heart surgery, and then like he stayed for another recovery afterwards. And I was living in LA, flying home on the weekends. At first, I was only flying home for a week every month, and then it ended up eventually being every weekend. Turns out that my wife who was staying with my parents was, they were starting to become a handful and becoming, I use this term delicately, but fairly abusive to her. And I don't mind them being abusive to me, but to her was the last line. I had roommates in LA that screwed me over so bad that we got into some, I needed some legal help. Started the studio, met Lou. Lou was so kind to me during that time. I went through a lot, and there was more things that I won't get into, but it was too much. And quite frankly, it led to a serious and deep depression. A depression that would last a long time, for a few years. I didn't notice it crept up on me. I didn't even consider myself to be depressed. That is not, DK is depressed is not something, I am depressed was not something that I thought. It snuck up on me. In retrospect, it was so obvious, but when you're in it, you don't realize it. I was sad. Some things that are more personal to me is I found myself talking a lot of shit, like about people, not like complaining, but like talking shit. Spending energy on things that didn't give me back any energy. Found myself laughing less, just totally removed from my baseline happy-go-lucky kind of DK. I was at the bottom. I was still, you know, I had my work ethic, but my brain was scattered and my heart was not in the right place. My family finally moved to LA with me, and we've been living with each other together ever since again. But like for the first couple weeks, I was just so far apart that it felt like I'd broken my family, that it was a family of three and I was just visiting in my own home. It was really bad. I missed almost an entire year of my oldest son's life. Hence why I take family so seriously. One day, I had to tune some vocals. I get frustrated like I always did recently. When I was depressed, I got frustrated pretty quick. And I got frustrated again, just like I usually did. Started complaining, saying things like, "Why can't this singer just learn how to sing? Why can't you just redo the takes until you get it right? Why don't you actually tune it before sending it to me?" Started complaining. I mean, now in my personal headspace or my former headspace at Baseline, I wouldn't do that. I'd just be grateful to be able to do this for a living. But I was complaining. I hated it. Anxiety was through the roof. I come off as fairly, maybe not calm, but I'm a lot more neurotic than people think I am. Just prone to anxiety. And I was feeling really anxious, and I was looking for anything to do besides work on these vocals. It was at that point that maybe I had been reading David Goggins. I don't remember. Maybe I was reading. I was probably reading 12 Rules for Life by Jordan Peterson. That was about the right time, I think. Maybe it was a podcast. Maybe it was Huberman. Maybe it was Chris Williamson. I don't know. Maybe it was a different book completely, and I'm totally off course. But for some reason, for the first time in my life, and at this point, I was making fun of runners. I thought, why would you run? I mean, I was friends with Shane Lance and Sendai Mike. Both of them are runners, and I made fun of them. I teased them. It's like, this crazy that you would put yourself through pain like that. Why would you do that? That's so stupid. That's silly. Like, it doesn't make sense. And I mocked them. And for some reason, I wanted to... When you procrastinate, all of a sudden, all the other things that you were also procrastinating become easier, because this one thing that you don't want to do becomes more difficult. So it puts into perspective in your own mind everything else that you want to do. So if usually this happens where it's like, I don't want to do this work. So instead you go and clean your room, you wash your dishes, you do other things in order to not do this thing that's harder to do. And for me, I was like, oh my goodness, I don't want to tune these vocals. I'm feeling so anxious about this. I don't want to work on this at all. And I'm feeling so much anxiety that I'm going to do the one thing that I never thought I would ever do because I heard it might help. And I went on my first ever run as an adult. I ran, I don't remember that first run very much. It was probably only like 20 minutes. It was probably too fast. Not as slow as I run now, which is a secret that we'll get to later. Because there were some people that were asking me advice on running and getting started and whatnot. So eventually I'll talk about that. But right now, I don't know what I did. I don't know why I ran. I just did. I remember doing it. And then I don't remember the run. I don't remember feeling hurt or being tired. I remember getting home and all of a sudden, immediately, as if I was a new me, I felt zero hesitation to start tuning these vocals to get back to work. The anxiety had been pulled away from me completely. There was no fear, there was no stress. I was motivated to work. It was strange. It was this weird sensation. I remember how strange this feeling was. It was almost as if I had lived a life without any real first world medication. Then I had just taken an ibuprofen for the first time in my life. I all of a sudden, the pain and the anxiety was just magically gone. I couldn't explain it. I thought, that's weird. So I tried it again the next day. And the day after that. And the day after that. And every day I came back feeling motivated, feeling better, mentally clear, less anxious, ready to work. I felt my purpose more strongly, even at a more micro level, what my purpose was for the day. I changed from that run. And it felt good. It was the type of change that I'd been looking for. And every day I kept fueling the fire. After about a year of running, quite often, less than a year, I started getting hurt. I mean, this is inevitable. So there is no data that shows that running is bad for your knees in the long run. In fact, the data shows that runners have the strongest joints, have the best hips, have the best knees, have the best ankles. By like a long shot, like it's not even close. Go look this up. Google it. Don't just trust me. I'm not a doctor. Go Google it. But you know, when you start running, when you live your entire life not running and sitting in a studio all day, and all of a sudden you start get up and impacting, putting pressure on your joints, there's going to be some inflammation and it starts to hurt. And it's about this time when every new runner starts to give up. Oh, my knees hurt. I need to take a break. So they get out of habit. You know, I'll just take this week off. And then all of a sudden, because they are injured, it's a valid reason. Like, oh, my knees hurt. My ankles hurt. It's from overtraining. I just need to take this week off. And then they get out of the habit and they don't get back out. And that almost happened to me. But then I remembered the amount of, after I was feeling better, I remembered the joy and the lack of anxiety the mental clarity, the emotional clarity, the spiritual cleansing of going out on a run. And after I was healed, after I started feeling better, I went back out. Then I get injured again. This time, I didn't want to be. It hurt. It hurt to run. I couldn't run. I had to walk. I was limping home one run. And I started crying. Stupid me, dude. I went from making fun of Shane and Sendai Mike to crying that I won't be able to run. I went home. Got mad at myself. Why am I so neurotic? I hate this. I'm just so riddled with anxiety. And I was so sad that this one thing that I've learned to cope with one thing that this one drug that actually worked was going to be taken away from me. Just like at that time in my frame of mind, everything was being taken away from me. And I was sad. Every 2 days, I try to run again, only to re-injure myself in the same spot, same part of the knee. Couldn't do it. And at this point, I decided I was going to run a marathon. I signed up for my first LA marathon, and here I am getting injured. I can't train. So there's the stress of that too. So I decided to take 2 weeks off, and that was tough. I took 2 weeks off literally a month before the marathon. Couldn't get my mileage right. I went into it with less training than I had hoped for. I didn't feel prepared. You're darn right, I finished that race, but mile 18 hit, I had never bonked so hard in my life. Bonking or hitting the wall, it's when you burn all 2,000 of your calories and all of a sudden your body just goes limp. It's not a muscle thing, it's literally just lack of electrolytes, lack of sugar and carbs. Your body has nothing to burn. Yeah, anybody that runs marathons or more or does endurance sports knows the importance of nutrition, eating, and drinking Gatorade while you're running. Underprepared, bonking really hard, barely able to run, almost collapsing at mile 18, knowing I had 8 more miles to go. And that was a lot of miles. 8 miles is a lot for someone that was new at running for me at the time. It's still a lot for me today. I don't know. Like that's an hour and a half of running my regular pace, right? And I had 8 miles left and I could barely run. I was walking. It sucked. Mental's in the wrong place. Unhappy, not smiling, taking myself way too seriously. That was probably really masochistic in retrospect. But I did the job. Took some ibuprofen, my knee worked out okay. Then catches up to where I said earlier. Then my buddy Mitchell Bashford. Mitch, please. He's been on the podcast. He said, I'm signing up. My friends convinced me and my brother convinced me to sign up for the Utah Marathon. I need to go back to Utah to visit some old friends, visit my old studio. So you know what? I said, I'll do it with you. But this time I trained better. And I had friends to go with me. The first one, I had no one with me. It was just by myself. This one, I had friends, at least at the starting line. And this time I was better trained. And I finished. I finished way faster than I thought I ever could. Partially probably because my knees didn't hurt and I didn't bonk. I didn't bonk at all. I did the proper nutrition. Drank my Gatorade when I was supposed to. Took my energy gels when I was supposed to. I felt better. And this marathon, it was really surprising. It was almost enjoyable. I had to second guess myself, like, holy cow, did I almost enjoy that? Turns out I did. I did enjoy that quite a bit. It was fun. It was exciting. I didn't have a next race, but I kept running. Running for my mind. Eventually my wife joined me after that and started running with me. Just started. She mentioned the same things. she said she felt like, as a mother, stay-at-home mom, she'd be running around in circles all day, cleaning a mess that the kids would remake, make that mess the same spot, the same way. Every couple hours, she'd come in and clean up again. And just, she said that she felt less effective just running in circles. I'm sure that's a difficult thing many moms can sympathize and us boys can empathize with, but she said, when she runs, the days that I run, I feel more effective throughout the day. I feel more in control. I also mentioned that, it was after the first marathon, soon after that, that I started taking therapy, weekly therapy, something that I knew myself I needed. I was way off baseline. So I started doing that, which was very supplemental. Eventually, you know, while I'm getting running shoes, I meet a guy named Josh at the store, Fleet Feet. Josh is an ultra runner. And at this point, I had finished David Goggins, the first book, Can't Hurt Me. Incredible book. It's one of those books that in a good way makes you feel like a bitch just enough to motivate you to do better. It doesn't make you feel like shit, but puts into perspective what difficult means. And when I read that book, I was like, oh my goodness, I didn't even know those kind of races existed. And on top of that, I didn't even know that was humanly possible. I mean, Pheidippides died. Bro that started marathons is dead. Granted, he didn't have aid stations, and he probably was super dehydrated. And he did it as fast as he can. Bro died. And we don't even know if that's even a real story, but the point is he died. And here David Goggins was talking about a 135-mile race through Death Valley in July. Hell nah. That's crazy. Anyway, but I put it in the back of my mind, something I might want to try later. After reading that book and continuing running, no race plan, no goal planned, just identifying now as a marathoner. I've done two. I do marathons. I'm a marathon runner. I meet Josh. Josh says, I've run Badwater 135, that David Goggins race, 9 times at the time. Incredible. Whoa, that's insane. I've never met anybody that has ever done that. And I just found out about these types of races. Look up to him. I couldn't speak to him. It's very intimidating to talk to him knowing that he'd done something so incredible so many times. And he's a regular 100-mile ultra marathoner. And I ask him about it. And he doesn't do what I thought he would. I thought he'd be kind of gatekeepy about it. He wasn't. He's very open about it. He's very kind. He encouraged me. It's like, yeah, dude, if you ever want to do it, just let me know. And I ignored him for months. I kept meeting him every single once in a while, asking him questions about it, just always in awe. Just, how did you train for that? How did you do that? What did you do? Holy cow. Were you beaten as a child? And then I asked him, it's like, do you have one that you recommend? If I were to go for it, I was looking at, usually with ultra marathons, people start with 50 Ks, which is 30 miles. People start with 50 milers, you know, 24 hour races. And I was going to sign up for like a 50 mile race. The most I ever ran on my birthday, I ran 30 miles for my 30th birthday this last September. And I did one more mile to make it 31. So it's a proper 50K. And I was hurt. My knee pains were flaring up again. I had to walk that entire last like 5 to 10 miles. I was in so much pain. And there's this trauma from that pain that I had and losing my ability to run all flooding back into me again. And when I asked him about this 100-mile race, my biggest worry was not being able to finish. It was, will I be able, like, will I not get hurt? Because I don't want to like lose my ability to run over this. Or gets, I don't know. There's just so many things going in my mind. And I said, which race should I do? And he said, this one here. It's about 3 hours east of where we live in LA. It's in the mountains. And I was like, oh, should I do the 50 miler or the 50K? And it's like, oh, you could do the 24 hour and you just see how many miles you can go in 24 hours. It's like, oh, that's cool. I might do that. Cause then I could quit anytime. I could just stop and I'd get my medal no matter what. And then he mentioned, but if you're trying to, and I was like, maybe I can hit 100 miles. I think I joked about it. It's like, maybe I can hit 100 miles in 24 hours. And then he said, haha, if you want to do that, you better sign up for the 100 miles because you get 36 hours. And so you get more hours to make it just in case you don't finish in 24. And that rage, not rage. This is like 3 months before the start of the race. I was not training for anything necessarily. I was training for the LA marathon that was coming up like a month before that. So it was like the LA marathon was in 2 months and then the ultra marathon was a month after that. And I was training for the LA marathon and I was like so surprised. I was like, no way. And I signed up and I was like shaking from the nerves. I was like, this is so scary. And I decided that I was going to challenge myself to see if I could even do the 100-mile race. But this time it was different. It was a totally different mindset from the first two marathons that I ever did. I had no idea if I was going to be able to finish. And I had accepted that. It wasn't about finishing. It wasn't even about anything. It was anything other than I love running. Running changed my life. And I have a hobby of challenging myself. Not to prove superiority, not to cope with the feeling of inferiority that I struggled with, but just to see if I can. No expectations. This goes into the idea that I had to let go of expectations with my son. Down syndrome, we know he's going to be like mentally disabled and his progress is going to be slowed down. I have to lower my expectations and something that I didn't know if I was capable of doing. And not only was I able to lower my expectations with him, but I learned something more beautiful. And this was followed up with a therapy session where I had a big breakthrough where I just learned about the idea way too late in my life and fully understood the concept of letting it happen. Let it be, let it happen. It is what it is. It just is. And to be is not good, it's not bad, it just is. And in my breakthrough at therapy, when I was talking about this, talking about my son learning to let go of expectations and just to enjoy the moment, just be grateful that he's with us when I didn't have him for so long. All of a sudden, like I have no idea, like we don't know how he's going to develop. There's no map, like no Down syndrome, two Down syndrome kids develop the same. Like we have no idea. It's such a broad spectrum. Like we have no idea. There's nothing other than to let go of expectations. There's no other choice. And I was sitting here and I had this breakthrough and had a moment where all of a sudden it was just totally silent. And I felt something that I'd never, ever felt like this before. It stood out. I was trying to think through it. Am I happy? Am I grateful? No, it wasn't that. It was nothing. It wasn't sad. It wasn't a nihilistic nothing. It was just tranquility. For the first time after putting it into words with my therapist, I realized everything is. It just is. It be what it be. It is what it is. It do what it do. And that's it. There is no need to add any sense of existentialism to my reasoning. I'm doing this because of whatever reason. This had been a long path to get there, putting briefly, at this time I'd been studying more closely my roots, my Buddhist roots. Also, I am East Asian, so it's like there's a little bit of this Eastern philosophy that you're born with, you know, it's common sense. And like, for example, in if you ask a Japanese, this is a very interesting concept between the East versus West, but the West is very much all about existentialism. Where do I come from? What's my point of living? Where am I going? They don't understand how to cope with the meaning of life without existential reasoning. Where, as far as the Japanese person goes, and in general, Buddhist Eastern philosophers, existentialism is not important, nor does it add any benefit to your life. The concept is Buddha would teach a story that says, if you're shot by a poison arrow, what is more important, to seek help or to seek the source of the arrow? Obviously, the answer is to get help, right? Looking from whence it came will only kill you faster. You are already in pain. You better start seeking healing is kind of the idea. And another example to kind of put this in perspective, because this is so foundationally different from a Western thinking that it's very difficult for most people to fully understand. In fact, you probably won't ever fully, anybody that's in from the Western world, Judeo-Christian, Muslim world, probably won't understand, but it's so fundamentally different. Even the concept of like when you ask a Japanese person, this is a very normal American question. When the Americans dropped the atomic bomb during World War II, what did you learn from it? Is it sad? Is it bad? Is it a necessary evil? Like, how did you feel about it? And a Japanese person is always confused by that question because we're in a totally different frame of thought. What is it other than just sad? It's almost dishonorable to try to put a reason on it. What do you mean necessary evil? It sucked. The end. Why are you trying to pull a lesson out of this? What lesson is there to pull from this? And it always confuses Japanese people. And they always do their best to try to explain this, but of course it never goes well because it is not something that you can easily explain in a conversation. It is a mind frame that is totally different. An American person cannot understand that a Japanese person can grow up and be in college and have never thought once in their life what they want to be when they grow up. That's not a normal thought to have for a Japanese person. And an American cannot understand, how can you feel any purpose in life if you haven't thought about that? Doesn't that just drive to suicidality? Doesn't that just drive you to depression and nihilism, which can lead to suicide? Feeling of lack of purpose. They don't understand. It's just immediately the Westerner thinks lack of purpose equals suicide. That's why. Little do they know that American suicide rate is higher per capita than Japan, but we won't even get into that. It's fundamentally different. And I'm getting on a tangent here. This is something that I think deeply on often and I'd love to explain to people. But it's backwards, like mentally backwards. And in this moment in therapy, it all came full circle, all the running, all the trials, my son, my family, my work, all the childhood trauma, it all came full circle into this one beautiful moment where I felt true and utter tranquility, just peace, just for a moment. And I sat there, and my therapist and I over Zoom, we were just staring at each other, and I said, I don't want to talk right now, let me just feel this. And I sat there for the remainder of the session, almost silent, wondering when this feeling would leave. When all of a sudden real life had, that I, as I had known up until that point, would start flooding back in again. all the complicated mixture of hope and anxiety and stress and relief and happiness, and none of it ever came. For about 10 minutes, I sat there, very aware of how bewildering, how amazing, how weird this feeling was. For the first time in my life, I felt like I had fully accepted reality as it was, and didn't feel like I needed to put a reason on anything. I bring this up because the last point that I want to make is what it means to be a high achiever. I've been distraught recently before that session. The deeper I go into the music industry and the more high achievers I meet, and this is my personal bias. This is not the case for everybody, but this is my story, so I'm going to tell it the way that I see it. I see my life. I was starting to become a little bit more nihilistic again, becoming afraid. I meet a lot of high achievers, and most of them, a lot of them in the music industry, it's very obvious that this desire to achieve greatness and this incessant need for attention and results and doing better than everybody else came from a dark place of being competitive, which usually comes from a seriously dark place of feeling inferior. I won't say on who, but it's someone, an engineer that we all love and respect heavily. When drunk, has told my other friends, "You will never beat me. I will always be greater than you." And he is a wildly successful engineer. Yeah, it's LA. It's a little dog-eat-dog. It's the entertainment industry. But the better I started doing with my career, the more I saw this, and my hope on humanity became a little bit less and less. It started eating at me. I started finding myself not wanting to be a high achiever. Ooh, I'd rather just be able to make a living and not win any Grammys. If that's what it takes, if to lose your mind like that and to constantly feel like you're competing with everyone around you, that doesn't sound like tranquility to me. That doesn't sound like peace to me. That sounds like misery. These sort of ideas sparked when I read the book, The Courage to be Disliked. Great book, fantastic read. I do recommend it heavily. And I talked about it on various episodes, and I reference back to it from time to time. And I started thinking about this idea of feeling inferior, that superiority complex comes from a deep secret feeling of inferiority. That book made me realize all the ways that I felt inferior to my dad, inferior to those around me, my colleagues, my friends, constant self-comparison, fear of being judged, all these other things that came from a generalized sense of inferiority that we all feel, unless you're batshit crazy. I was becoming more aware of this, and I started losing hope, and then I go on this ultra marathon, thinking the same thing. These high achievers, these assholes that are over-competitive, over-comparing. And as I mentioned before, it wasn't anything like that. At the end of the day, when you hit mile 80 and you realize that your feet and legs and your hips and your ass hurts and you still have 20 miles left, what really motivates you to finish? I'm going to tell you right now, if you had any sense of what I felt in my first race, which is a sense of trying to prove yourself, that comes from a deep-seated insecurity, feeling of inferiority. And if you know that you are inferior and thus you're trying to disprove yourself from the foundation of you knowing that you are inferior, feeling inferior, then at the end of the day, that does not work as motivation when you are a mile 80. Doesn't work. Lots of people DNF'd. Mile 70 through 80 through 90 is the death zone. Lots of people DNF. People DNF 5 miles before the finish. DNF is did not finish. It doesn't work. You know what else doesn't work? To prove to yourself or to disprove someone. Those don't work. Doesn't work. To be competitive. Doesn't work. Some people may have that so much so that they can just grit their teeth and bear it, but doesn't work. Typically. And it showed, because none of the people there that were finishing had that mindset at all. 0%. Most ultra, first off, ultra running skews heavily older women. We're talking 45 to 70 years old. It's mostly majority older women. Surprisingly so. I met a lot of cool people, and you talk to all of them. I mean, you're running for hours, so, and in a loop, so you're passing by everybody, so you run at the same pace as somebody else or walk with somebody else and just talk to them. You get to meet a lot of people. All of them are so kind, so courteous, so every time we pass each other constantly, and never once did we ever pass each other silently. It's always, good job, keep it up, you got it, we got this, looking strong. It was motivation. It was inspiration. It was happiness, and it was peace. And and not a single person was there trying to beat someone else. No. Maybe there's one or two bad eggs out of the 40, 50, less than 100 runners in the various different races. And no, that doesn't work. That's not motivating. At the end of the day, it could take you so far, but... I realize in order to do great, in order to do beyond incredible, this final glass ceiling, not final, I'm probably going to have more, but this final glass ceiling that I felt like I was in, I thought that if I can prove to myself that I do this, then I will become confident. And it turns out it was the exact opposite. Turns out that I needed to heal and put in the work and realize, lose all expectation, and to just fucking love running. That's it. Just love it and have no other reason. I want to finish. I like challenging myself and being aware of that, but it's not to prove something. It's not to beat someone else. It's just because I love it and I love challenging myself. To remove all competitiveness. When you're at fucking mile 80 and your feet feel like death, like you're stepping on hot coals, the ones who can keep going and finish are the ones that are already healed, that have already figured their life out, that are already happy. You don't gain happiness by getting to these upper levels. You don't become the best celebrity or the best musician or the best producer. No, you don't do that. And some people will. And just like they did for me, they'll misguide you and they'll think that that's what it takes. No. To do great, you need to find peace first. You need to accept yourself first. And maybe it'll take you less time than it ever took me. But I'm sure I now understand how much work it took, how much effort I'm continuously putting in, how much pain, of physical, my knees, you know, just running, that I had to get over. The people that I need to forgive and to let go of, the amount of ego that I needed to get over in order to find some level of peace. And when I did, and I was able to run this marathon with a smile, ultra marathon, with a smile almost the entire time, and I just enjoyed the process. When I got to mile 80, the only thing that I knew, without a shadow of a doubt, was that finishing was just a matter of time. There was nothing between me and the finish line. There was no injury that could stop me because I'd been training for it. And there's no injury that can stop me. There's no person that can put me down. There's not a single thought that I can have that'll put myself down. The only thing, I've done the work. I've healed. I feel better. I'm strong. I've done the work. The only difference between me and the end is time. and I knew that without a shadow of a doubt. And I do the same thing now. The only difference between me and a Grammy, the only difference between me and doing significantly better, whatever my goals are, is nothing other than time. And when I run, when I feel that little discomfort, that manageable, purposeful discomfort, that becomes more aware. I become significantly more aware of that. When I run, I remember that only some pain and discomfort is within my choice, like is within my realm of choices that I can make. Most of it, most of life, it just is. And I have very little, I can't control it. I may have some impact, but I can't control it. But when I run, this is pain and discomfort that I can control. When I run, I remember and I see it every single time I hit those streets. I put on my running shoes on. I see it. I can visualize it. The only difference between me now and me in the future with whatever I want to do, the only difference is time. And every time I put on my shoes, I make sure of it. And I feel it. Whether I get a runner's high or not, doesn't matter. It's just me. And time.
Perfect timing, bud. Yeah, you having a good time? Say, I love daddy. Say, I love daddy.
Anyway, that kind of wraps up this episode. I'm not trying to convince you to run necessarily, although it helped me and changed my life, and maybe it sounds like it's changed a few others too. I've gotten some DMs and I've gotten some close friends to do it. Say hi. But in general, I just want to close by saying there's hope. There's strength within you. There's peace to be found. There's joy to be had. There is love to be, love to find, love to make, love to create. I don't know, whatever. Joy to be had. I said that already. So I'm getting distracted. Are you having a good time? Yeah. And I hope everybody that's listening can feel the impact of my journey in order to help yours. And I'm not as articulate as I want to be. What are you going to do? Say Elmo. Say Elmo.
Elmo.
Yeah, say Elmo.
Elmo.
Say Daddy. Dada. Anyways, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, allowing me to vent. We have a lot more of our journey to go through. We have a lot more of our journey to go through, and I hope that I will continue to be able to have meaningful experiences and that I'm able to continue to share them with you. And I hope that my journey and my experiences can help you as much as they have helped me. And on that note, happy mixing, my friends, and stay saucy. Say bye! Bye!